Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content. They may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. The boss sat in the bed of a troop truck, bound for hardstand number 34, the home of a B-17G named Georgia Bell. The crew he was going to be flying with was an experienced one, with 11 missions under their belt. The boss found out during the morning mess that the crew flew three of the five missions the 300th flew during Big Week. The boss and his crew were already familiar with the pilot of Georgia Bell, First Lieutenant Clyde Duke, because he was the one who told them about Captain Blue's plane having been shot down over the target. The boss also discovered that once Clyde and the other two officers found out that the boss flew his first mission with his rookie crew to Berlin, their attitude towards him was noticeably different. In fact, most of the other officers had a completely different attitude towards the boss and his crew once they heard that they were the, quote, rookies who survived Berlin. After the briefing, the boss learned that their target that morning was to a rubber factory in Ludwigshafen, Germany, just across the Rhine River from Mannheim, Germany. Georgia Bell, along with two other bombers from the 530th Squadron, would be flying as backup in the 531st Squadron, since they were low on men and airplanes. The morale of the men was low, and the boss could feel it. Even Colonel Poole that morning seemed tired and aggravated over the mission as he gave the briefing. The mission was going to be a long one, well over 11 hours. What made things even worse was, the 300th was going to be flying in the low wing of the rear of the formation. In the 531st Squadron, the squadron the boss and Georgia Bell would be flying in would be in the low squadron, otherwise known as Tail End Charlie. It was a bad spot to be in, and high losses were expected. As the boss prepared himself mentally for what he was going to possibly be experiencing over the next 12 hours, he felt the troop truck slow down as it arrived to the hardstand of Georgia Bell. Once the boss was standing outside, he couldn't believe headquarters was going to try to attempt to fly a mission that day. The sky was full of dense clouds, and the airfield was wet from a cold, icy rainstorm that came through a little after midnight and stopped hours before the men were woken up. Darker clouds hung in the air just north of the airfield, and the boss swore he saw snow falling from the sky as he walked towards the plane he was going to be flying in. The B-17 he was going to be flying in, Georgia Bell, was an early G model with smaller windows lining the sides of the nose compartment. The nose art was only on the left side of the nose. It was positioned between the last two windows on the left side of the nose, and it was that of a dark-haired woman with curly hair, dressed in a revealing blue swimsuit and tan sun hat. The words Georgia Bell were painted next to her. As the boss continued to walk towards the plane, he caught a glimpse of his plane, Load of Bull, parked at its hardstand. The rudder had been replaced, and most of the horizontal stabilizer had been patched up. The boss saw Butch standing by the Bull and proceeded to walk over to him, since he had plenty of time to chat with him before doing pre-flights. The boss called out to Butch, and the two met halfway. "How can I help you, my lord?" Butch sarcastically said with a big smile on his face. "Lord? Ooh, I like that, Butch," the boss replied. "No, seriously. How can I help you? I got a lot of things to do this morning. I can't believe they're going to have you guys up in the soup, especially after going to Berlin," said Butch. "I was just checking on the Bull, see how she's coming along," the boss said. "Well, it hasn't been easy. You brought her back pretty shot up. I've seen and worked on a lot worse, but it just hurts me deep down inside to see her come back all shot to hell. It pained me to hear about your gunner, Al. It's always hard when you see young kids like that get hit," Butch remarked. "How bad is she?" the boss asked, seeming to completely brush past the comment about Al. "Well, we tried keeping track of how many holes, but since we didn't go to no college, we lost track after 120. Three of your largest holes were on the right side. Which, by the way, do you know that you had a football-sized hole in your right wing?" Butch asked. "I did. Was it that bad?" the boss asked. "Bad? It went right through your Tokyo tank. Good thing all that fuel was used up. It would have been a mess for you for sure," remarked Butch. "Well, it's a good thing we have you as our mechanic," the boss said, giving Butch a wrist slap to his arm. "Yep, I just getting too old to be fixing up planes like this. You flying with boy Duke today?" Butch asked. The boss nodded his head. "I like Duke. My buddy Elmer's their crew chief. Listen, when you do your pre-flight checks with him, don't look at Elmer in his eye. He's from down south in the Bayou area. He'll cast a Cajun spell on you. Just ask Duke," Butch said in a joking manner. "All right, Butch. Thanks for the tip. I better head back. Keep up the good work. Hey, if you bring back Georgia Bell with less than 120 holes, take one of Elmer's screwdrivers and make some more for him. Give that old swamp-ass son of a bitch some work," Butch yelled out, purposely so that Elmer could hear him.
"I heard that! You're older than me, you rat-faced prick!"
Elmer yelled back. As the two mechanics bantered back and forth, the boss began to feel rain hitting him on his head. He hurried back to his plane, and he did his pre-flight checks with Lieutenant Duke. 30 minutes later, the boss was sitting in the co-pilot seat, waiting for the green flare to go off. The icy rain covered the top of the battle-ready bomber. The boss looked down at his watch and watched as the minute hand passed by the 6:45 mark, the time that they were supposed to be starting engines. No green flare was seen. The anticipation killed the boss as he and Duke's crew waited to find out what was happening. The boss just wanted the mission to start and be underway. Within 5 minutes, the crew of Georgia Bell, along with all of the other crews, received the call over the radio that the mission was canceled due to bad weather. All of the men cheered as they went back to their huts, as they would get to live for one more day. Later, March 8th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0725. The boss entered through the front door of his hut and was shocked to see Jack, Rosie, and the men from Hailing Mary still lying on their beds. The sounds of heavy sleet hitting the top of the metal-curved roof made the dark, semi-warm room feel calming, which was an odd feeling even to men like the boss. He was tempted to lay back down in his bed and try to catch some more sleep, but he was too full of energy to do that. He was invited to join Duke and the men in his hut for a game of cards over coffee. He was going to invite Jack and Rosie to join him, but neither of them lifted up their heads as the boss entered into the hut, meaning that they were still asleep. Not knowing what else to do, he slowly made his way out of the door and let the men enjoy some sleep. About an hour later, Jack was woken up to the sounds of men talking. Rolling over in his bed, he discovered that the sound was coming from Joe Brolin and O'Brien, who were talking to one another. Jack sat up in his bed and saw that Rosie looked freshly showered and was finishing getting dressed. After noticing Jack was now up, Brolin called out, "Good morning, Sleeping Beauty." "Morning," Jack replied back, stretching his arms out and rubbing his eyes as he did so.
"Your pilot got lucky. The mission got canceled due to bad weather," Brolin commented.
Jack, remembering that the boss was selected to fly a mission by himself, felt horrible as he had slept through what would have been the alluded time that he would have been taking off.
"Don't worry, I slept through it too,"
Rosie said after seeing the guilt wash over Jack's face.
"Where is he now?" Jack asked.
He's over with Boy Duke from Georgia Bell, Hut 301 if you want to join him."
"Boy Duke?" Jack asked.
"Yeah, everyone calls him Boy Duke. His real name is, I don't remember his name,"
Brolin admitted.
"Jerry,"
O'Brien guessed.
"No, it's something strange like Rhymes or Magnolias,"
Sheila commented.
"What the hell, are you drunk, Sheila?"
Brolin asked.
"I wish."
"No, it's Clyde," Brolin fired.
"Yeah, that's it. Clyde, Sheila, you're fucking still drunk. Who the hell names their bastard kid fucking Magnolias?"
Coca asked.
"I don't know. Clyde's an odd name,"
Sheila commented.
"No, it's not. You need to sleep off the hangover some more before you talk again. Anyways, what are you two doing today?"
Brolin asked Jack and Rosie. Both men shrugged their shoulders.
"Well, we're going into town tonight once the weather clears up if you want to join us,"
Brolin said.
"Town as in Haverhill?" Jack asked.
"Yeah, or maybe Cambridge. Do some sightseeing,"
Brolin suggested.
"That sounds like a plan. What about you, Rosie?"
Jack asked. As Rosie shrugged his shoulders again, that's when the sounds of someone knocking on the door rung through their hut. Everyone stopped in their tracks for a moment before O'Brien asked,
"Who the hell knocks? This is the army. We don't knock."
O'Brien walked up to the door and opened it. Jack wasn't able to see who was standing on the other side. All he saw was O'Brien's reaction.
"Is St. Louis here?"
said the voice.
"Who?"
O'Brien asked.
"St. Louis. The kid from St. Louis?"
"Nobody here is named or goes by the name of St. Louis. You have the wrong hut, pal."
"No, I was told the 299 was St. Louis's hut. Now I know he's here."
Jack suddenly realized who was at the door. Jack quickly got up as O'Brien was about to get confrontational with the individual. Jack arrived at the door to see the tall man, Timothy Parnell, from the night before. He was by himself and seemed unfazed by the ice collecting around his shoulders of his leather jacket and his officer's hat.
"There he is, St. Louis,"
Parnell called out.
"You know this asshole?"
O'Brien asked.
"Hey, who you calling an asshole?"
Parnell asked.
"You. I'm calling you an asshole, pal,"
O'Brien yelled out. The two exchanged heated words for a few seconds before Brolin, Sheila, Coca, and Rosie arrived at the door and joined Jack and O'Brien. Parnell lowered his voice and said,
"All right, okay. St. Louis, you remember me, right?"
"I do."
"Okay, well, let's start this over again. Can I come in?"
The men stood in shock for a moment before Jack said,
"Yeah, come inside."
Parnell, with gusto, walked in, pushing past the other airmen. Once Parnell arrived inside the dimly lit, dark, warm hut, he turned around and remarked,
"Cozy."
Joe, who seemed to be very irritated, spoke up by saying,
"Listen, pal, I don't know where you were raised or what your ma taught you."
"Massachusetts," Parnell interrupted. Joe stopped what he was saying and stared at Parnell with a look of confusion. O'Brien stared at Parnell and suddenly realized that he had been speaking with a Bostonian accent.
"Where in?"
O'Brien asked.
"Brockton,"
Parnell responded.
"Last name?"
Joe asked. "Parnell."
"Any relation to James Parnell?"
Joe asked.
"Yeah, he's my brother. You know him?"
Joe's face lit up, and that's when he said,
"Jesus Christ! Know him?
He's only the single greatest Golden Glove goddamn boxer in Massachusetts. Holy shit, O'Brien. Remember me talking about Jimmy P and that one-hit knockout I saw him do?
O'Brien nodded his head.
Jimmy P is this guy's older brother,
Joe said, pointing back to Parnell. O'Brien then sprung into action.
Oh, why didn't you say you were from back home? Jesus Christ, look at you. You're all wet from the rain. Here, sit down. You want some coffee?
No, thanks. I'm just here to grab old St. Louis, Parnell remarked.
St. Louis, huh? I didn't know you were from St. Louis,
Sheila responded. Jack stood in an awkward state, not knowing how to react in the situation, so he just nodded his head.
Look at him. You can tell he's not from where we were raised, Joe said, giving Parnell a nudge.
Jack looked over at Rosie and was shocked to see that he looked indifferent as he was now sitting on his bed again.
What squadron you in?
Koga asked as Parnell didn't have a squadron patch on his jacket yet.
530th. We just flew in yesterday,
Parnell responded.
Oh, hot damn. Fresh meat,
Sheila blurted out.
Yeah, you could say that. We would have been here 3 days earlier, but we got stuck in that goddamn whiteout in Newfoundland. 3 days we spent eating spam and drinking melted snow before we were able to get back in our plane and make it here, Parnell explained.
Over the next few minutes, Parnell explained to the others that he and his crew had originally flown with 4 other crews across the Atlantic, but 2 had to turn back due to mechanical issues, and the other crew was still stuck in Newfoundland. Once they reached Ireland, they grouped up with a bunch of new planes headed to England as replacements, and 7 of them were headed to the 300th. The men were all wired up from their trip and wanted to do something fun and exciting to let off some steam. Joe invited Parnell and his crew to join them for a venture into town later that night if they would let anyone off the base. Parnell agreed. Saying a few last words to Jack, he said his goodbyes and left the hut. Skippy had woken up with a massive headache and was still lying in his bed. The cold weather caused the men to stay inside their depressing hut, and each man was trying to find ways of keeping themselves occupied. Willie, Tommy, and Beans were playing a game of cards on Tommy's bed. Mills was lying on his bed looking at an issue of Newsweek magazine.
Anything good in there, Milsh?
Willie inquired.
Nope,
Mills commented.
Nothing?
Tommy asked.
Not a thing. I'm going to start reading some books,
Mills countered.
Boy, I would have loved to hear you say that,
Bean said, then suddenly realizing how dark and depressing his comment was. Looking over at Al's empty bed, Tommy saw that Al's footlocker was still sitting at the foot of his bed.
When do you think they're going to take all of his stuff? It's been 2 days,
Tommy asked the group.
I don't know. They haven't even come for Jodite, Bruce's, or Schmitty stuff yet,
Mills replied.
Should we, you know, check it out?
Willie asked.
Check it out? What does that mean?
Mills asked.
Yeah, you know, see if there's anything in it that, you know, we don't want his mom, his father to see. Maybe something that we want to keep, you know, to remember him by?
Willie asked as he grabbed himself a cigarette to light.
Should we?
Mills asked.
Oh, I don't like the sound of that. That's his stuff,
Beans commented.
I know it is, but what if he has something like a rubber or a pinup magazine in there? We don't want his mom seeing that,
Willie defended.
You know, that's true. I have things in my footlocker that I wouldn't want my parents to see,
Tommy said.
Yeah, all right, good point there, Willie. All right, for Al's sake, I'll do it.
Mills said, sitting up in his bed and made his way over to Al's footlocker. Skippy rose from his bed, looking shocked and horrified. Mills bent down and grabbed the lock and then looked up and asked,
anyone know where Al kept his key?
You don't need it. He keeps the lock part inside the hole, but he doesn't push it down all the way so it looks like it's locked,
Willie called out. Mills pulled down the lock with little force and the lock opened.
Nice, Willie. I'm not even going to try to ask you how you knew that,
Mills commented.
Don't ask, and I won't tell,
Willie added.
Oh, look at that. He had one rubber. Funny how you knew that all along, Willie,
Mills said, going through Al's belongings. Willie, with a grin on his face, said,
yeah, what can I say? I know what Al Boy had. It's a gift that I have.
As Willie talked,
Beans and Tommy both got up and joined Mills and helped him go through Al's stuff. Mills pulled a leather-bound book from the chest called For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway. Mills opened the front of the book only to see a handwritten note. It simply said, Covington Reform School, to Mr. Brew, you have shown great growth and potential these last few weeks. I hereby give you something that I think you'll find life-changing. I know it was for me. Sincerely, Mr. Benton. Mills didn't share the note with anyone else. He just let off a smile and proceeded to put the book on the floor next to him.
What was that?
Beans asked.
One of Al's books. I think if I asked him, he'd recommend this one to me.
The men all went through Al's stuff some more and found nothing more that they wanted to take from it before they made everything look neat and tidy and closed the lid and locked it. Mills stood up, grabbed the book, and walked back to his bed. As he did, he saw Skimpy standing next to his bed, looking at the shelf above Al's bed. Mills looked and saw that Skimpy was looking at Al's notebook.
Do you want it?
Mills asked Skimpy. Skimpy looked back at Mills and shook his head.
Are you sure?
Mills asked.
I'm sure,
Skimpy responded.
I think he'd want you to have it. Seriously,
Mills said, walking up to the notebook and then handing it to Skimpy. Skimpy looked down at the notebook, opened it, and saw where Al had finished writing. Mills patted Skimpy on his shoulder and proceeded to walk back to his bed. 2 hours later, the enlisted men were surprised when the door of their hut opened up and were greeted by two corporals. The two corporals informed the men that they were there to gather up the belongings of Bruce, Jodite, Prusen, Schmitty, and Al. After the men confirmed that this hut belonged to them, they then watched their friends' belongings get collected and taken away. Then, one of the corporals informed the men that they would soon be moving to a new hut. When Willie asked for further information, the one corporal told them that with so many new crews coming in, Colonel Poole announced that the enlisted men were to gather their things and move to a new assigned hut when it was their turn to move. The men of the Bull didn't know at this time, but Colonel Poole realized that he had to do something to get the morale back up on the base. He knew that more than half the Quonset huts on the southern end of the airfield were not being used, and so he gave out the order that for the next 2 days, all enlisted men would get their own huts, assigning 6 to each hut instead of 12. Once they heard the news, Willie and the others jumped up from their beds and began packing, preparing to head to their own bunk.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, there's good news for you, because you can. By visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free resources to help you know more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can actually take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the one depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, free YouTube videos, and much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. You won't regret it. Now, back to the podcast. Later that night, the Cock Inn was bustling with airmen from Thurlow. The men all had a 24-hour pass issued to them that didn't run out until 4 o'clock the next afternoon. With this news, many of the men made plans to stop at the Cock Inn in Thurlow and slowly make their way into downtown Haverhill for a night on the town. Along with the swarms of men was the boss, Jack, and Rosie. The boss had been with the crew of Georgia Belle and Cap'n Kids all morning long, getting to know them. Cap'n Kids was another experienced crew with over 10 missions under their belt. The pilot, 2nd Lieutenant Sean Bernhausen, and co-pilot, 2nd Lieutenant Henry Merkel, both bunked with the crew of Lieutenant Duke and his crew. The boss was looking for them in the overpacked room of airmen who were all more than ambitious to drink as much liquid refreshment as they could handle. The three officers were standing to the left of the bar in the back of the bustling room. Jack was waiting to see if either Parnell or the crew from Hail Mary would find them in the densely packed bar. Neither of them were in the hut when the order came through, and Jack hadn't seen either of them since earlier that morning. Suddenly, the boss's voice rang out.
Hey, 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 gentlemen! Long time no see!
Jack looked over and saw that the boss was talking to two officers who Jack didn't recognize. The first man was introduced as First Lieutenant Walter Hillhouse of Springfield, Illinois. He was an average-height man with a long, thin, narrow face, short, almost shaved black hair, tan skin, and seemed completely uncomfortable with the rambunctious tone of the room. He had a tightness to his chest that led Jack to believe that he had seen combat before. However, as the boss introduced Hillhouse, he told Jack that the rookie pilot was a cop back in Springfield before joining the Army Air Corps. Jack, surprised, leaned in to shake Hillhouse's hand. The other man the boss introduced was a taller man with wavy, combed back blonde hair. He brought an intimidating presence due to the fact that he had a very stocky body build and a strong jawline. He was introduced as Second Lieutenant Lewis Benson of Minneapolis, Minnesota. The boss explained that Benson was, in his words, a, quote, wizard at playing guitar and can play any tune just by hearing it. Jack shook Benson's hand and learned that Benson was Hillhouse's co-pilot, and they were among the large group of replacements that had arrived the day before. Jack understood that the boss was trying to make as many friends as he could, and Jack didn't mind. The boss was a very social person who always wanted to know and be acquainted with everyone that was in a room. However, up until the mission to Berlin, many of the airmen, with the exception of Mickey, turned their noses up to the boss and his crew. Now, that barrier was gone, and the boss was wanting to invite all the new crews into his newly circle of influence and social clout. The boss and the two airmen talked to one another for some time before another man joined them. This time, Jack recognized them. It was Matthew Nebo, the man the boss and Jack met the night before at the officers' club.
Hey, 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 it's Nebo, right?
The boss asked.
Yeah, good memory,
Nebo replied before taking a sip of his beer.
What are you drinking there, Nebs?
Benson asked.
Something called a stout,
Nebo replied.
Oh, I love me a good English stout,
Hillhouse said, picking up Nebo's glass and taking a sip from it.
Hey, 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 I was drinking that,
Nebo shouted.
Cool down, Dick. I was just taking a sip,
Hillhouse fired, wiping his top lip.
Get your own,
Nebo said. Hillhouse gave Nebo his drink back and proceeded to nod his head several times and said,
Oh, I think I will in a bit. It's not half bad.
Get me one too whenever you go up there, Benson added.
With a smile on Hillhouse's face, he replied,
What do I look like to you?
A man who needs a beer and is going to get his buddy one?
Benson shot back. As the two men bantered back and forth a bit, the boss looked over at Jack with a huge smile, almost his way of saying, Aren't these guys funny or what? Jack smiled back and enjoyed the banter for a little bit longer. Over the next half an hour, the six officers stood by the bar, drinking their beers before heading to their next stop, Haverhill. The enlisted men were all sitting at a table in an English pub known as the Dugard Tavern in northern Haverhill. The men all had cigarettes lit, with the exception of Willie, who had a large cigar in his mouth. The tabletop was littered with empty beer glasses and whiskey glasses, and the airmen were enjoying the sounds of Joe Loss and his orchestra playing on the record player.
There is no way, Willie,
Mills called out as he was slumping back in his chair.
Yes, there is a way. I saw him with my own eyes,
Willie yelled back.
You're telling me that you saw the Elliot Ness?
Yes, he came to my dad's office. I don't know what's so hard to believe about that. I don't know what he was there for, but I saw him with my eyes.
And how old were you? Mills asked.
I don't know, 7 or 8, Willie commented.
Why don't you believe him, Mills? His dad worked at a courthouse and worked with prosecutors who locked up criminals,
Tommy defended.
I just have a hard time believing that the Elliot Ness came and talked to your dad. I just have a hard time believing that,
Mills reinstated.
Well, believe what you want. I know I saw him, And my dad knew him. I'll ask him whenever I write to him next. Willie fired. As the men sat in silence for a few seconds, they were utterly surprised when they saw a group of girls enter into the pub. They all looked to be in their early 20s. The five men's eyes were glued to the six British girls as they walked in and headed towards the bar. Two of the girls noticed the young airmen watching them and proceeded to make soft comments to one another and giving off a few chuckles. "Jesus, Mary, and fucking Joseph," Willie said as his eyes were glued to the women approaching the bar. Willie then turned his head back to his pals and gave off a huge grin. "What are you thinking there, Willie?" Beans asked. "I think I'm gonna go over there," Willie said back. "Going over there to do what?" Mills asked. "Just, you know, go over there and make some new friends. You boys stay here. Let me do my magic," said Willie as he stood up and proceeded to walk to the bar. "Well, there goes our chances of having a night with some broads," Mills called out. "No, I've seen him work before. Just watch," Tommy said, pointing to Willie. Within a few minutes, Willie was walking back to his crew, with women following him. Willie had the biggest grin on his face as he arrived back at the table. Mills was stunned and couldn't believe what he was seeing. It was like a miracle of biblical proportions unfolding before his very eyes. About a half mile down the road, towards the center of town, the boss, Jack, Rosie, Hillhouse, Benson, and two other officers were having drinks and taking turns playing a game of darts. The pub that they were in was called the Old Shepherd and was built in 1776, and it was a typical two-story white stone structure with dark wooden windows, doors, floors, and a bar. The walls matched the exterior walls and were adorned with paintings and pictures. The pub was dimly lit inside and the room smelled of cigarettes and pipe tobacco smoke. The other two officers playing darts were friends of Hillhouse and Benson, who met up with them as they were leaving Thurlow. The one officer was a pilot, and the other was his co-pilot. The pilot was 36-year-old Captain Anthony McCormick, also known as Texas. His co-pilot was a 24-year-old San Francisco native, Christian Mueller. Texas was tall, about the same height as the boss, and looked older than he was. This was due to the fact that he had receding hair, wrinkles under his eyes, and also around his mouth. Shockingly, the boss already knew who Texas was long before meeting him that day. Texas was a flight instructor back in the States and taught men like the boss how to fly multi-engine aircraft. He only knew the boss for about a month or so before he had moved on with his training, but the boss must have left quite the impression on Texas, for he remembered him specifically. Jack had spent the last 10 minutes hearing Texas tell stories about how exceptional the boss was at flying and was one of the fastest learners he had ever seen. Jack listened intently and enjoyed seeing the boss have a connection with someone else outside of war, other than Andy. As Texas, the boss, Rosie, and Benson played the next round of darts, Hillhouse, Jack, and Mueller started talking just off to the side.
"I tell you, your pilot's one hell of a character," Mueller observed.
"He is. He's a damn good pilot and the chief, if you ask me," Jack said.
"Is that why you call him the boss?"
Hillhouse asked.
"I guess. I don't really know how he got the nickname, to be frank. I just have always known him as the boss,"
Jack said.
"How is he with the rest of your crew?" Hillhouse asked. "He's great with them. You know, we're lucky to have him,"
Jack said before a moment of silence fell upon the men. That's when Hillhouse spoke up by saying,
"Hey, I've been meaning to ask around, getting some ideas. Do you guys have your plane named yet?"
"We do,"
Jack responded.
"What did you guys call it?"
"Load a bull."
"Load a bull?
Like, load of bullshit?"
Hillhouse asked.
"Right? I know, it sounds awful. I wanted to name it Bomboozled, but my vote got shut out,"
Jack said.
"I like Bomboozled. It's a lot better than Load a Bull. I would have fought harder for the name," Mueller commented.
"I know, but I have to remember that he is my chief and I don't want to overstep, you know,"
Jack said, instantly regretting what he was saying.
overstepping? It's just the name of a plane. Man, he's got you trained like a dog, doesn't he?
Hill House said, looking back at the boss.
No. It's not like that. I was taught to, you know, respect my elders,
Jack softly said.
I see,
Jack asked the two men.
So, what are you going to name your plane?
Oh, ours is already done. We had ours done back in the States before we left, Mueller said.
What's it called?
Jack asked. From Texas with Love, Mueller responded.
Oh, I saw your plane, yeah. It's a real nice paint job,
Jack complimented.
Thanks,
Mueller said.
Well, who did your nose art?
Jack questioned. Hill House raised his hand.
You did? Both sides?
Jack asked.
Yep, took me 2 days, said Hill House. 2 days? Hell, that's a lot.
It was a labor of love for a buddy, Hill House added as he drank more of his beer.
So what's yours called?
Jack asked Hill House. We haven't come up with a single name yet. Just none of the ideas we've come up with, none of them sound right. But, you know, I'm sure one will come to us. Why, do you have any ideas? Hill House asked.
Bamboozled,
Jack said with a huge smile on his face.
Oh, you're funny. We might just have to do that if we don't come up with a better name here in the next few days. I heard it's bad luck to be flying with an unnamed plane,
Hill House said.
I heard that too, Mueller added in.
As the three men talked more, that's when Parnell, Adam, Nicholas, and the men from Hailing walked in through the door.
St. Louis, we've been looking for you,
Parnell said as he walked up behind Jack and threw his arms on Jack's shoulders and squeezed him. Jack was startled by Parnell's thundering voice and was surprised to see him.
You thought you could escape us?
Adam asked with a large grin on his face.
No, I just didn't know where you guys were, Jack said.
I see you're making some more friends other than your dad there, Parnell said, pointing over to the boss. The boss turned around and didn't look amused. He stopped his game of darts for a moment and walked over to Jack and the others.
Well, I don't think I've met you yet, the boss said, introducing himself.
No, I don't think you have. Nice to meet you, Timothy Parnell, Parnell said, introducing Adam to the boss. The boss gave some small talk to the other two officers for a little bit before Parnell flung his arm around Jack's neck and pulled him towards the bar. Jack, with his neck still stiff, shuddered with discomfort, spilling his beer.
Oh, sorry.
I heard you took some flack to your noggin, Parnell apologized as he let go of Jack. Jack shrugged it off and said, it's fine.
Here, I'll buy you a new one, Parnell said after seeing the spilled beer.
You don't have to, said Jack.
No, I should.
I want to, Parnell said as he approached the bar.
What do you want? Parnell asked.
Ale is fine. That's what I was drinking.
Very good,
Parnell said before he arrived moments later with two fresh glasses of ale for both of them. Jack walked with Parnell back to where the others were standing, and the group conversated for the next several hours.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news, because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, as well as Q&A episodes. That's a lot for you to dive into. There is so much for you to gain just by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you'd like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. If you click that link, it will take you directly to our page. Any support goes a long way in helping this podcast continue. Thank you to all of those who have already subscribed and are currently supporting this podcast. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Again, if you'd like to be a part of the podcast and you'd like to support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page and donate $3 or $10, and you will receive an incredible amount of bonus content that will help you have a better experience as you listen to Snafu. Speaking of which, let's get back to our podcast. Back at the Dugard Tavern, the men were all enjoying the company of their female companions.
who have slowly over the last hour and a half grew rather fond of the young men. Each man had a girl sitting on their lap, listening to either Willie's account of his first fighter kill, Mills' days at the REO plant, or Tommy's funny stories about his father. Even Skimpy had a young 18-year-old girl sitting on his lap. Willie, Tommy, and Mills kept making excited faces at Skimpy when their girls looked away. Skimpy continued to feel uncomfortable, that was, until he had more to drink. With every drink he had, he felt more carefree, and, at least from his perspective, the girl sitting on his lap was taking more of a liking to him. In reality, the girl on his lap found Skimpy rather cute and adorable. Her name was Emma, and she found men like Willie to be a bit annoying to her. He just seemed too stereotypically American. Turning around to face Skimpy, she asked him to describe what it was like back in Waterloo, Iowa. Skimpy didn't know how to respond to the young girl.
It's like, I don't know, it's just like it is out here. It's just not as green, I guess. Lots of farms, cornfields, and such.
Well, what did your family do? Emma asked.
My mom and dad are vegetable farmers, Skimpy replied.
Emma then explained, rather excitedly, that her father was a vegetable farmer too, and shared that she lived not too far away from Thurlow. Skimpy was stunned to learn this information, and after asking him a few more questions and Skimpy giving her short answers, Willie said out loud,
You're gonna have to excuse my friend here, Emma. You know, he's never had a girl this close to him before. Conscious, that is.
The group chuckled at the joke, and that was when Emma turned around and said,
Is that so?
Skippy's face turned red, as she then leaned down and whispered into his ear. Willie's face lit up as he and Tommy both gave each other looks of disbelief as Tommy and Emma then got up and proceeded to walk out of the pub.
Make sure you wear a rubber, Skimpy!
Willie yelled out as Skimpy exited the hut with Emma. Outside, Emma and Skimpy stood next to the front door and told Skimpy that she didn't like how his crewmates were talking to him and she wasn't a fan of the loud music and the loud talking. Skimpy agreed and asked Emma where they were going to go. She gave a big smile and then asked him if what Willie said about him was true. Skimpy then said that what Willie said was in fact true, that the fact that a woman had never been so close to him before. Emma then gave off a nervous chuckle and said,
Well, that's a shame. Have you ever been kissed?
Skimpy replied that he had not. Emma then leaned in and kissed Skimpy on his cheek. Skimpy gave off a huge smile, and that's when she told him that she had never been kissed before either. Skimpy stood in silence for a few moments before Emma asked him if he wanted to change that for her. Skimpy gave her a big smile and leaned in and landed a kiss on her cheek. Emma then leaned in again, and Skimpy met her, and the two began kissing and soon moved to the alleyway next to the pub. 10 minutes later, Willie and the others walked out of the pub and were getting ready to head to one last pub before going back to the base. However, Skimpy and Emma still hadn't returned. Some of Emma's friends were concerned, and once they were outside, one of her friends called her out by name and then was then joined by Tommy, who began calling Skimpy's name. A muffled voice rang from the alleyway.
Yeah? Coming!
Seconds later, Skimpy and Emma emerged from the dark alleyway, and from what Willie could see, Skimpy's clothes looked rather disheveled, and he could see that Skimpy looked shaken up. Emma joined her friends with a huge smile on her face, and the group began to whisper to each other.
Had fun, Skimpy? Tommy asked.
What? Skimpy fired back.
Oh, come on, Skimpy. We all know you were holding a foreign affairs meeting in the alleyway.
Willie joked. That was when the girls said their goodbyes to the Americans, and the boys all said their goodbyes, with Skimpy blowing Emma a kiss to which she received and walked away smiling. As the boys began walking down the road, talking amongst themselves, Willie kept his smiled face glued in Skimpy's direction. Skimpy could feel Willie looking at him, and after a few moments, turned around and asked him,
Yes? How was it?
How was what?
Crossing another thing off your list.
Willie, leave him alone, Bill said.
What? Did you or did you not cross something off of your list?
Willie asked.
Skippy was silent for a few seconds before he shot Willie a smile and said, "I might have crossed some things." Willie began clapping his hands together and then threw his arms around Skimpy's neck and said,
"Holy hell, Skimpy! You are becoming a man. No. You know what? Here, you are a man. I want you to have this,"
Willie said, taking off his wristwatch. "What is it?" Skimpy asked.
"Don't worry about it. Give me your hand."
Skimpy moved his arm over to Willie, and before he knew it, he had a heavy gold watch around his right wrist.
"It's my dad's gold watch he gave me when I turned 16. Don't you fucking lose it."
Skimpy stopped walking and stared at the gold watch, dimly illuminated by the moonlight. Willie and the other stopped and looked back at Skimpy and asked him if he was all right. Skimpy looked up with tears welling up in his eyes and simply replied, "Yeah, I'm fine."
Thank you for listening to Episode 9 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you'd like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canto 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness of the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies over Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for Episode 10 of Snafu, Target for Today.